You're listening to Naked Astronomy with me, Dominic Ford, and now it's time to find out what's been in the astronomy news this month with Robert Massey from the Royal Astronomical Society.
This month and in the next few weeks, we've got an interesting moon probe going to take off. This is a NASA project, and it has the acronym LADEE, L-A-D-E-E, which stands for Lunar Atmosphere and Dust Environment Explorer. And what this one will be doing is traveling to the moon on a fairly conventional rocket system, orbiting the moon for a period of about 100 days. And the aim of the project is to study the dust that's found on the surface of the moon that might at some point pose a hazard for space missions and also for any explorers in the future.
The moon's a geologically dead environment, and we've always sent a lot of spacecraft to it in the past. What more is there to learn about it?
The moon is certainly, to all intents and purposes, geologically dead in the sense that you're not talking about an environment where there's lots of lava moving around as you have on the Earth. But on the other hand, it is active. It's obviously affected by extremes of heat and cold because it doesn't have an atmosphere. So although it rotates slowly over a period of a month, the fact that it's rotating at all will mean that you experience changes and stresses on the rock and so on. And the purpose of the mission is to look at this dust that covers the surface. Now, if you imagine a body without an atmosphere, that's very vulnerable to anything in the surrounding space environment. So meteorites crash down onto the surface essentially unimpeded. And unlike on Earth, even the smallest ones make it straight down onto the ground. If you have those things on Earth, we'd probably see them as a shooting star. But on the moon, they crash down onto the surface and they grind away at it. And so the surface of the moon over billions of years, thousands of millions of years, has become made up of this compacted and crushed up rock. And that's essentially what you find there. And a lot of it's very fine. It's in the form of dust. And it can be suspended by electrical charge at various points as well. So if you have ultraviolet light striking the surface, the stuff that comes from the sun, then it can charge the particles, it can ionize them, stripping off electrons. And what that means is that they can then end up floating, because if you get repellent electric charges, that exerts a force, and that force can be enough to lift this material off the surface of the moon. And that's the kind of thing the mission will be looking at.
I suppose there's also the interesting factor here that the moon is in some ways very Earth-like, but in other ways it's not very Earth-like.
There's no really equivalent phenomenon on the Earth, and that's because we have a thick atmosphere, so you know any kind of elevating effects and so on are absolutely dominated by the wind that blows material around instead. But it would be something of a problem if you wanted to explore the moon. This stuff, this very fine dust, not only could perhaps damage instruments, you know, if you had a rover traveling around, particularly in the twilight regions of the moon, as the moon's rotating, if it was carried into twilight, that would be a bit of a problem because it might actually get dust dumped on top. But also, if you're an astronaut and you go and explore the surface, obviously you do that in the spacesuit. When you come back into your spacecraft, you bring some of that with you. And the Apollo astronauts found that it had a fairly unpleasant taste of gunpowder. It was also quite acrid, and it made some of them sneeze. And there is some concern about the health effects on people working and living on the moon if they weren't exposed to this dust on a regular basis.
Sticking with other bright objects in the night sky, we were hearing earlier in the year about this very bright comet that's going to be in the sky in November. People said it might be the comet of the century, but I gather it might turn out to be a bit of a disappointment.
It's contentious. The object that we were looking forward to at the end of the year, and I think still are actually, is Comet Ison. Discovered by a robotic network of telescopes in Russia, and it's been named after that, although, to be fair, there are actually a couple of scientists who probably need to be credited for it as well. But this object was thought, because it was coming very close to the sun, and also was very, very active a long way from the sun, the supposition was that when it got close into the inner solar system, it would become very bright, and certainly once it had passed by the sun and was heading out into space again. Now, there is some debate as to whether that's still likely to happen because the activity levels on the comet haven't lived up to expectations. Now, this is actually nothing unusual with comets. Quite often they can be active when they're far out, particularly if they haven't come into the solar system before, and that looks like it might be the case for Ison, and then the activity can fall off a bit, and that seems to be happening here. So it may not be quite the object that people were expecting, and you know there's always an unfortunate tendency for these things to be hyped. But that said, it could still be quite a nice comet as these things go. It could still be visible to the naked eye late in the year, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere. So we in the UK might get a really good view of it in the last couple of weeks of the year. But we'll just have to wait and see. It's, I'm afraid, one of those things where comets are a bit like cats. The description is that they have tails and they do exactly what they want.
What's that telling us about the structure of the object?
The difficulty in understanding their activity is that they can have a variety of materials. I mean, they have ices, mostly frozen water, but other gases as well inside. And when they get close to the sun, that stuff heats up and it goes straight from being ice to gas because you need some kind of atmospheric pressure for material to become liquid, so it doesn't go through that phase. Now, the determining factor is really how much of it's exposed. If the comet has quite a thick rocky crust or debris crust or dusty crust, then it's much harder for the heat of the sun to reach inside, and it also there are fewer vents for the material to come out. If, on the other hand, that's rather thinner, then you'd expect more of the material inside to come out. So probably those factors, the exact proportion of water ice and all of those things determine how active the comet's likely to be. So it's quite difficult to actually know much more about it when it's still this far from the sun. If you send a space probe to it, I guess you'd have a very interesting look indeed. But with this sort of object where we don't get a lot of warning that it's coming, I mean, a year sounds like a long time, but it isn't in space project terms. To actually get a mission organized to go and look at something like that on that scale would be very difficult. So there's no prospect of that. But we can probably make some deductions about it by comparing it with other objects.
From memory, when ISON actually makes its closest approach to the sun in November, it's going to be actually quite incredibly close. That will be a very extreme environment that those ices will be exposed to.
Well, ISON is going to go within about 1.1 million kilometres from the sun's surface, and given the sun is 1.3 million kilometres across, that's really a very close approach indeed. Now, there's, again, a lot of debate about exactly what will happen, because there was another object, the comet Lovejoy, that made a similar approach a couple of years ago and turned out to be quite robust. It actually came through it quite well. And there was a paper by the Astronomer Royal of Scotland, John Brown, on this around the same time, and he pointed out that you have to consider that although it's a hot environment, being that close to the sun, quite clearly, there isn't much in the way of a solar atmosphere at that point, so objects can pass through it. It's the ones that plunge directly onto the solar surface clearly are going to be destroyed, but further out, it's a lot harder to tell. So I think the jury's out on whether it will survive. If it does survive, it may turn out to be a very nice comet indeed. We just don't know.
Now, I gather you've been especially interested this month in a paper about lead concentrations in the atmospheres of stars.
Now, that's right. There's a team at Armagh Observatory have been looking at this unusual sort of star called helium-rich subdwarfs. Now, that requires a bit of explanation. Basically, these are stars that have a much higher concentration of helium than our sun, for example, because they've gone through quite a lot of their lives, and they've used up a lot of hydrogen fuel, and even more exotically in this case, they've gone through the stage that the sun will go through, too, of becoming a red giant star, shedding their outer atmosphere. They're doing that early for some reason, and what you're left with is a part of the star that's still doing its nuclear reactions and so converting hydrogen to helium, but there's a lot of helium there. What the team have found is that even more exotically, two of the stars they looked at seem to be incredibly rich in lead, and what they think is happening is that the pressure of the light, the radiation emitted during these nuclear reactions ultimately, is pushing the lead atoms or the lead ions that stripped off, in this case anyway, stripped off electrons, pushing them up in the star's atmosphere, and it creates a very sort of rich layer of lead, much, much richer than you find, say, on the surface of the sun. Now, I mean, if these stars, and they won't, were to explode, they would distribute that into space, and so there are probably other mechanisms for getting this material off it, but you know, they're certainly very exotic objects, and the numbers are quite incredible. If you look at the mass of the layer, it's something like 100 billion tons of lead and about 100 kilometres thick, so really quite a lot of this stuff.
I tend to think of stars as being all much the same. They're all clouds of hydrogen and helium, and they're all producing energy in a similar way with nuclear fusion. What fundamentally is making these stars different?
Well, I mean, the difference in this case is that it's an exotic subclass, and the researchers actually say they're not certain about their origin and evolutionary track. But what seems to be the case is that they evolve. They've gone a long way through their lives, and so they've used up a lot of the hydrogen fuel that they're made from originally. So the amount of helium in them, because stars shine, at least for most of their lives, by turning hydrogen to helium, and that reaction releases a lot of energy, the amount of helium is much higher. And added to that, if you lose all that outer hydrogen as well, then you've got an object which looks very different to stars like the sun. Really quite odd things. It's very hard to say what their fate will be, but they are certainly very different to our sun. And there's a whole wealth of objects like this as well. I mean, you only have to think about white dwarfs, the remnants of stars like the sun, very different to the sun during the bulk of its life. Black holes as well, you know, once were stars, at least the majority of them we find in the galaxy. So, you know, there really is something of a menagerie of objects. But in another sense, I mean, most of their properties are determined just by how much mass there is, because that dictates how strong their gravitational field is and affects their brightness. So, you know, more massive stars look very different to much less massive ones.
And of course, people always say that we are stardust and that all of the heavy elements in the solar system came ultimately from stars. So I guess it's stars like these are really affecting what we would imagine the universe is made of.
Well, that's right. I mean, it depends on the fate of this star. It doesn't seem likely to me that these lead-rich stars are likely to become supernovae and so violently distribute their material into space in an explosion. But even if they just blow it off in the form of dust, that would enrich their surroundings. And you're right, if you run the clock forward billions of years in the future, some of that lead may end up on planets like our own. It's exactly where all these elements came from. And virtually everything heavier than helium actually was made in stars. There's a little bit of lithium and beryllium formed in the early years of the universe, but beyond that, everything else is made in stars. So without a generation of stars having lived and died, not only would the Earth not be here, but we certainly wouldn't either.
That was Robert Massey from the Royal Astronomical Society.